who were left behind by the monarchy's uneven development model. In rural areas in Iran, the expansion of health and education led to a clear reduction in poverty. The 1970s poverty rate of 25% dropped to less than 10% in 2014. These social politics, biased in favor of the poor, helped explain why Iran's Human Development Index, HDI, has been relatively positive. Most Iranians today enjoy access to basic services and infrastructure, while the population has almost doubled, and most of the country is urbanized. Other measures of social development have similarly improved. Literacy rates has more than doubled, especially among young women, and now encompasses almost all the population. Meanwhile, female students have outnumbered their male counterparts at universities for more than a decade.
Time now to take a look at some of the posts on this topic from social media to websites. First up, a website that we looked at, World Bank, has put Iran's economic growth in 2023 at 4.2%. It said Iran's economy has registered growth in 2023 compared to a year earlier. And the World Bank had put Iran's economic growth in 2022 at 3.8%, adding the World Bank expects that Iran's economy to grow by 3.7% for the year 2024. Then Iran exporting technical engineering services overseas in water, wastewater, and sector, one of Iran's achievements. The country has gained good achievements in the field of constructing equipment needed in the water and wastewater sector. The private sector, it said, has paved the way for the accurate management of water consumption in the country. Then viewer comments. This viewer said Iran is a beautiful country with beautiful people. Worked there for 7 months and will cherish it forever. And finally, Iran's economic performance since the 1979 revolution, slow GDP and GDP per capita growth has led to widespread perception that income inequality has worsened. But in fact, Iran's income inequality, as measured by the Gini index, shows a slow downward trend and has improved. So there you have it. Just some of the different ways that Iran has advanced throughout the years and decades. Ali Rezmanpour, who's an international affairs expert, joining us. I will start first with you, Ali Rezmanpour. Welcome to Economic Divide. Let's do a flashback here in terms of the Islamic Revolution and from the point that it occurred and as it progressed, and in particular, in terms of the classes, how it brought the different classes together. Especially when it comes to, for example, the improvements that were made in the rural areas. That's the thrust of my question here, where in the capital you had most of the services, but it expanded when the Islamic Revolution happened. How much of an impact did that have, especially in preparing them to contribute to the economy more?
In the name of God, the compassionate and the merciful. As you mentioned very correctly in your first question, the Islamic Revolution, of course, was the result of interaction and cooperation of different groups and societies in larger Iran, which they played a significant role in the victory of the revolution. So because, you know, we have differences of social classes in Iran. That's why we witness different kinds of crises throughout our country. These conditions caused the workers, the employees, and other members of the society as part of the greater Iranian nation, inspired, of course, by the thoughts of the late Imam Khomeini, peace be upon him. In addition to their demands, to the union demands, to the workers, and also deprived sections of our society, they decided to overthrow the Pahlavi regime, because they were deprived of the basic rights, mainly education. The education and all facilities were mainly focused in the capital. So by the time of the Islamic Revolution, we had witnessed different kinds of, conditions for all members of society to participate in different sectors of life in our Iran, of course, in Iran. And also, the government played a greater role in this respect. The revolutionary capacities of Iranian nation caused them to assume greater role and also influence their, status in society in order to process the revolution and also try to advance the revolution to attain its goal. That's why we witness different kinds of, achievements in different sectors of society, especially those deprived people who didn't have any opportunity to promote their education in different parts of Iran.
It's time now for the Info News section of the program. First up, a motion that has been going for some time, and that's the boycott of not only the Israeli regime's goods, but also of the U.S. Israeli-linked boycotts are hurting U.S. brands in West Asia. Consumers in Muslim-majority countries have shunned companies like Starbucks, McDonald's, and Coca-Cola over the Gaza war. They called it a conflict in the century. We call it the U.S.-Israel genocidal war. Then job cuts happening in one of the biggest companies in the world, namely Microsoft, the world's most valuable company, announcing job cuts. Microsoft is deciding to lay off 8% of its workers, and this would be for the gaming unit. It still is signs of it needing to make cuts, which may point to other areas that have cuts maybe coming up in the future. So it's something that we need to watch out for. Then we take a look at this particular entry where the title caught our attention, EU industrial collapse. And it said unions are sounding the alarm over EU's industrial collapse, where high energy prices are dampening production and hurting the region's competitiveness. So the EU needs to watch out for that. This is back in the spotlight again because of what's happening really in the Red Sea, where the Yemeni army is targeting Israeli-linked and bound vessels. And this next entry actually talks about that, Europe's oil supplies, okay? It says oil supply is tightening in Europe over the Red Sea disruptions, adding that the volume going to Europe from West Asia has nearly halved amid continuing attacks by Yemen's, they call them the Houthi rebels, but it's really the Ansarullah movement. Those were some of the items that we picked where we thought it was important.
Financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Time now for the in-depth section. Although the Islamic Republic is marking its 45th anniversary, each successive government has played a role in advancing Iran's economic agenda. And that's very important when it comes to the Islamic Revolution's goals. Iran's current president, Ebrahim Raisi, has played an important role in that regard, especially after world powers failed in their commitment, for example, under the JCPOA. So let's take a look at some of the economic indicators under Raisi. Service sector, in which Iran registered a growth of 6.2% for the year 2023 compared to the year 2022. Obviously, the improvement that's there. The service sector remains one of Iran's largest, with financial intermediaries that have driven its gains. Next up, we go to another sector, industry and mining, which may have had no growth in the year 2022. However, it did rebound and register 3.7% growth for the year 2023. Now, keep in mind that this figure actually excludes Iran's oil and petrochemical sector on the one hand, and also this sector still lacks the necessary machinery and equipment that would give them access to many of the mines and the potential there, although the financial resources and foreign investments has lacked in that sector because of the U.S. sanctions. Let's go to the next sector, which is the agriculture sector. Again, the economic growth there is quite remarkable, 2.7% growth for the year 2023. Remarkable in the fact that you have things like wheat production, which increased by 6% for the year 2023. That actually put the Islamic Republic in 14th place among the world's top producers of this strategic grain. Next up, well, Iran's oil and petrochemical sector. Obviously, you can't disregard that. It actually saw a huge rise in production for the year 2023. It jumped from 3.5% to a whopping 16.4%. So much was the increase that it showed itself also in the GDP of Iran. It actually contributed to 24% of the contribution that it made to Iran's GDP. Iran still maintains that it should not have oil production as the means for its economy to be driven, especially when it comes to its GDP. So when you put all of these together, let's take a look at how the 13th administration actually performed. Looking at the year 2022, we saw Iran's economic growth registering at 3.8%. For the year 2023, that's 4.2%. For the year 2024, the projection is a little bit lower at 3.7%. Just to put things into perspective, OPEC countries' average is 1.9%. And when it comes to the Islamic Republic's economy in the MENA region that it is in, it came in and ranked number 3. All right, let me bring back our guest for this segment in the depth section. We have Ali Rezvanpour, international affairs expert. Taking a look at the focus of my question here is Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi and his 13th administration. What can be said? There's been lots of improvements, membership at some notable trade blocks like the BRICS and the SCO. There's been obviously the push to decrease inflation, which has been successful of some sorts. But what do you think about the economic performance of the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi?
Yeah, you referred to a very good question. Because of being under the sanctions, we became self-sufficient in different kinds of, technological fields. So by being self-sufficient and standing on our feet, we try to improve our GDP in our society and also be self-sufficient. But one of the core issues in which, Raisi administration focused was improving relations with the neighbors, because by improving the relations with the neighbors, we try to achieve our targeted goals. One of the most important steps in this field, of course, President Raisi's, achievement, was pursuing a good neighborhood policy, focusing on improving political relations, of course, with various countries in our neighbors, in order to challenge the West, in order to challenge unjustified policies in which the West has imposed on Iran. So the culmination of these, achievements was the membership of Iran in two or three important, groupings, namely BRICS, Shanghai Cooperation Organizations, and Eurasian Economic Cooperation. So these membership in these organizations try to diversify our sources of supplying and also improving our export and import in order to be self-sufficient and not put all our eggs into the West baskets. So just continuing the policy of good neighborhood by, improving the relations with neighbors, we can try to just fill the gap in different kinds of, fields in order to be self-sufficient and also try to challenge the hegemony of the West, which is trying to unjustifiably impose their will on Iranian nation.
A major factor that has contributed to the economic advancement of Iran has been the sanctions that have been applied against the country for decades now. The sanctions have made some hardships for Iran, but they have helped the country rely on its own capabilities. In the field of health and medicine, Iran has achieved astonishing growth and great improvements. Life expenses. Furthermore, before the revolution, Iran was completely dependent on foreign countries for its military needs. In 1977 alone, Iran's dependence on other nations for weaponry amounted to more than $5.5 billion, with $4.5 billion accounting for the U.S. share of these imports to Iran. Over 31% of the country's budget at that time was spent on arms purchases, but after the revolution, Iran has restored and enhanced various military capabilities and has made significant progress, especially in the areas of missile power and drones. Iran's economy under the current President Ebrahim Raisi's 13th administration has been able to decrease inflation in many sectors while improving Iran's GDP. Iran is now an active member of BRICS group of countries and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Iran attracted $6.05 billion of foreign investments between August 2021 and March of 2023, up 84.3% compared to the same period in the previous administration. According to the World Bank, Iran's economy has started to rebound, supported by a recovery in services post-pandemic, increased oil sector activity, and accommodating policy action.
Hello and welcome to the Quick Take section. I'm Matt Diapossian. As Iran marks its 45th anniversary, we will cover three issues of importance in this section. First, the Vision 2025 adopted in the year 2005, then the resistance economy and Iran's literacy rate. It became known as the Vision 2025 adopted in 2005. Provision of social justice, health, welfare, equal opportunities and fair distribution of revenues. Enhancement of cooperative spirit and responsiveness. Fast and constant economic growth, increase of countries' per capita revenue, and access to full employment. After the Vision 2025 on the one hand, and there came another doctrine which helped Iran excel in many fields. It was called the resistance economy. This was an economic plan promoting innovation. The resistance economy doctrine was to make the Iranian economy resistant to all external economic shocks. This included Western sanctions and global financial crises. It also set out an agenda to steer away from oil. One of the major accomplishments of the Islamic Republic has been in the field of education, not only among the masses, which is quite remarkable, but also when it came to women. Here are some before and after facts, like from 47.2% to 93.2%. Also of note are the percentage of high school students. The number of universities is also reflective of how it helped advance the education of Iranians who wanted to pursue a college degree. This has been the backbone of Iran's advancement in different fields, particularly science and technology, in such fields like nuclear energy, aerospace engineering, and so on. And when it comes to women, here's a snapshot of how far women have come in the Islamic Republic. The average value for Iran during that period was 88.31%. And that does it for this Quick Take section.
That does it for this edition of the program. Thank you so much for tuning in to our program this week. We do appreciate it. For me, Kavit Tahwe, and the entire team here at Economic Divide, it's goodbye until the next program.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
At least 10 other countries quickly followed the United States, including the UK and Germany, in pausing aid to Palestinians. This group of historic and present-day offenders has now been dubbed the Axis of Genocide. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. The Electronic Intifada wrote, the U.S. government had a prompt response to the International Court of Justice ruling that Israel is plausibly committing genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza. The response was to defy the court's rulings. It took only a few hours for President Joe Biden's administration to temporarily pause funding to UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees. The ICJ, a body of the United Nations, also known as the World Court, had ordered that Israel must take immediate and effective measures to enable the provision of urgently needed basic services and humanitarian assistance to Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Apart from the Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu condemning the court as anti-Semitic, the Zionist regime's main response has been to change the subject. In contrast to the Biden administration's months-long refusal to stop the killing of Palestinians in Gaza, the administration's quick response to the Zionist regime's bid to change the subject was striking. Under the previous president, Donald Trump, the U.S. halted UNRWA funding in 2018. In 2021, the Biden administration resumed U.S. economic assistance to the agency, but at least initially only at half the pre-Trump level. Seeking to get ahead of the story, UNRWA director Philip Lazzarini announced that he had fired several employees and was launching an investigation, apparently to confirm what he had already done. He claimed to protect the agency's ability to deliver humanitarian assistance, I have taken the decision to immediately terminate the contracts of these staff members and launch an investigation in order to establish the truth without delay. Any UNRWA employee who was involved in acts of terror will be held accountable, including through criminal prosecution. Lazzarini did not specify in which court such a prosecution would occur. The implication seems to be that it could take place in the Zionist regime's apartheid courts. These courts that for decades have dispossessed Palestinians administer a two-tier legal system with a military justice system and a 99.7% conviction rate for Palestinians tried in military courts in occupied West Bank. Lazzarini's attempt at preemption did not stop the United States from pausing aid to Palestinians in the midst of a genocide. At least 10 other countries quickly followed the U.S., including the UK and Germany. This group of historic and present-day offenders has now been dubbed the Axis of Genocide. Francis Boyle, the first lawyer to successfully argue a genocide case at the ICJ, told MSNBC anchor Ayman Mohiuddin recently that by halting funds, these countries had made themselves active participants in the genocide. Boyle said, the cutoff of UNRWA funds with no due process of law, no investigation, nothing at all of that nature for governments that did this, they are now in violation of 2C of the Genocide Convention. deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. The Zionist regime has long sought to disrupt and destroy UNRWA. The UN agency established in 1949 specifically to protect the Palestinian refugees expelled by the Zionist regime during the Nakba. UNRWA provides essential health and educational services to Palestinian refugees in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip, as well as in Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria. The Zionist regime's long-held intention to destroy UNRWA was revitalized late last year when the Zionist regime's foreign ministry privately laid out plans to push the agency out of Gaza altogether. Netanyahu said, "The time has come for the international community and the UN itself to understand that UNRWA's mission must be ended," he added. "UNRWA is perpetuating itself. It seeks to preserve the issue of Palestinian refugees." Netanyahu, of course, wants to wipe out once and for all the right of Palestinian refugees to return to homes and properties they were forced out of in 1948. The UNRWA crisis has now exploded into the news cycle at precisely the moment focus was briefly centered on the ICJ's concern about the Zionist regime's actions in Gaza. Israel's politicized charges have been critically examined by Maureen Morphy and Intercept's Ryan Grimm. Western media have rushed to focus on the UNRWA charges. In the mainstream media, this has largely dislodged from heavy news attention the ICJ's ruling that Israel is plausibly carrying out a genocide. Instead, there is breathless reporting on the UNRWA allegations. CNN's Catalan Collins interviewed Dan Senor, former chief spokesperson for the U.S. occupation authorities in Iraq, on the UNRWA developments. Senor proposed effectively that Palestinians be ethnically cleansed to Arab countries. There was no talk of their return to Gaza, let alone a return to land their families were expelled from in 1948. In a statement posted recently on the Hamas Telegram channel, the organization asserted that the Zionist regime's new campaign against the UN agency was an epithet in an organized attack launched by the occupying state against UNRWA, targeting its existence, drawing up its funding sources, and liquidating it for political motives in order to liquidate the Palestinian cause and the right of return for Palestinian refugees. There is almost zero talk in the U.S. of where those refugees came from and the ongoing significance of Israelis living in Palestinian homes and on Palestinian properties for over 75 years. It's a story that must not be told. The fabricated regime of Israel is making clear it does not want UNRWA to be part of the effort to rebuild Gaza following the apartheid army's scorched earth policies of the past few months. The Zionist regime officials, even if they prove unsuccessful in forcing a voluntary ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from Gaza, hope to permanently bury the right of Palestinian refugees to return home to 1948 lands and properties. Recently, witnesses testified before the House Subcommittee on Oversight and Accountability, chaired by Congressman Brian Mast. Earlier, in Israel's onslaught, Mast accused all Palestinians of being Arab Nazis. Mast has cast doubt on the presence of innocent Palestinian civilians, initially standing by his statement, before later trying to walk the claim back after facing political pressure for openly expressing anti-Palestinian racism.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
زمان علیه السلام تو این دعا یکی از فرازاش اینه و علی النساء بالحیاء والعفه.
In a beautiful supplication, Imam al-Mahdi Jalallah asks Allah to give the women of the Muslim lands chastity and modesty. This is when both men and women of a society need to be chaste and modest. But why Imam al-Mahdi asks Allah to safeguard the chastity of the women of a society?
شاید به این جهت که زن مهمترین سرمایه‌هاش در گروه حفظ عفتشه.
This is because the belongings of a woman are within her chaste character. Thus, if this treasure, which is chastity, is lost within a woman, both men and women of a society might fall into the traps of the Satan. In other words, chastity for women, especially Muslim lands, is the gate to the spiritual perfection of the society. Therefore, women must be more careful about their modesty and chastity in the society, since their soft nature can be darkened if they fall into the trap of the satanic temptations or the evil thoughts of the men of a society. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
امام جعفر صادق پیس بی اپان هم هستد Whoever remembers us, the Ahlul Bayt, and his or her eyes fills with tears, his or her face will never burn in the fire of hell.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
It has been 44 years since the Islamic Revolution in Iran, a popular uprising that toppled the U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime, changing the course of the country's history. Led from exile by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the uprising toppled the U.S.-backed despotic monarchy and replaced it with an Islamic Republic, ushering in an era of political freedoms and independence from foreign influence. The revolution brought about significant economic progress to the country. It was made on behalf of the Mostazafin, the downtrodden, who were left behind by the monarchy's uneven development model. In rural areas in Iran, the expansion of health and education led to a clear reduction in poverty. The 1970s poverty rate of 25% dropped to less than 10% in 2014. These social politics, biased in favor of the poor, helped explain why Iran's Human Development Index, HDI, has been relatively positive. Most Iranians today enjoy access to basic services and infrastructure, while the population has almost doubled and most of the country is urbanized. Other measures of social development have similarly improved. Literacy rates has more than doubled, especially among young women, and now encompasses almost all the population. Meanwhile, female students have outnumbered their male counterparts at universities for more than a decade.
The Islamic Revolution, after its victory, managed to change the political geography and geopolitical structure of the region. The credit for this change goes to the nature of the discourse of the Islamic Revolution. The ideological framework and the valuable human content presented by leader of the revolution, Imam Khomeini, may his noble secret be sanctified, as the speaker and founder were able to create a new model and introduce a new composition to the region and the world as a whole. With the victory of the Islamic Revolution, the people of the region realized that they could stand against the West and the East and change the equations. The successive failures of the Zionist entity and the United States of America in the region indicate that the Islamic Revolution was the source of inspiration for the peoples of the world, and especially in West Asia. Certainly, without exaggeration and in a scientific and objective manner, we can say that the period before the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran is not the same as the period after it. At the level of the conflict with the Zionist enemy, 1 year before the revolution, Egypt had signed the Camp David peace agreement with the Zionist enemy, and it was said that time that Egypt's exit from the conflict meant that the conflict with this enemy had ended, and the agreement with Jordan was added to it. Many expected that the resistance against this enemy would end after these agreements, but the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran brought the region into a new equation and into direct conflict with the Zionist enemy. Since the first days of the Islamic Revolution, Iran has clearly stood against the Israeli entity, and as is known, it closed the Israeli entity embassy and turned it into an embassy for the state of Palestine, and stated clearly that this entity is illegitimate, and confirmed that it will stand by the legitimate resistance in Palestine, and this was a new equation. No one could have expected it. This seemed to bring about major changes in the resistance movement and in the development of the resistance movement in Palestine and the region of West Asia. The pressures of the U.S. and Zionist Israeli attacks and divisive projects targeting Islamic communities that we witness today are a direct result of the existence of this resistance. If it weren't a strong axis of resistance, the United States wouldn't need to exert these efforts, carry out attacks, and impose sanctions. Therefore, today's confrontation is clear and challenging, especially since the axis of resistance in West Asia has become an essential part of regional and international equations.
The Association for Israel's Soldiers is based in occupied Palestine and claims to be the sole avenue through which donations can be made directly to IOF soldiers and IOF units. These donations come from Zionists in Palestine, as well as from the US, Canada, Brazil, Mexico, France, and the UK. The UK Friends of the Association for the Well-Being of Israel Soldiers is a registered charity which is obliged by law to show public benefit. Its charitable objectives include relief of need and suffering, advancement of education, and provision of facilities for recreation of the occupation forces. Guidance published by the Charity Commission states that it is a legal requirement that any detriment or harm that results from charitable purposes must not outweigh the benefit. Perhaps supporting genocide outweighs those purposes. Amongst the trustees of the charity are Colonel Richard Kemp, a former British soldier said to have hateful views on Islam and Muslims. In December, the BBC was criticised for interviewing Kemp without reference to his role as a UK Avis trustee. In one recent interview with a pro-Israel blog, Kemp was quoted as describing the killing of civilians in Gaza as necessary. Palestine Declassified has traced around 20 charities which have donated to UK Avis over the last 15 years. The following are notable donors: Gerald and Gail Ronson Family Foundation, which was created by Gerald Ronson, the convicted fraudster, who runs the Rontec company, operating over 250 BP and Esso service stations in the UK. Ronson also set up the Community Security Trust that runs point of the Zionist regime in the UK. Though one of its charitable objectives mentions opposing extremism, this is yet another example showing that Ronson, in reality, supports extremism and genocide. Loftus Charitable Trust, set up by the Loftus family, which made its money from the watchmaking firm Accurist. It also funds the extremist Zionist sect Shabbat Lebovich, Islamophobic think tanks, Jewish supremacist groups in East Jerusalem, and the Community Security Trust. David and Ruth Lewis Family Charitable Trust, set up by the Lewis family, which own River Island clothing chain. The charity also funds Islamophobic think tank and illegal settlements in East Jerusalem. The Family Foundations Trust, set up by the UK property investor Richard Mintz. The charity has funded the extremist sect Shabbat Lebovich, Islamophobic think tanks, and the Community Security Trust. Richard's son and charity trustee Joshua co-founded the website Friend a Soldier, an online platform where soldiers can become digital ambassadors. UK Avis is already under investigation by the UK charity regulator, the Charity Commission. The investigation should widen to include the nexus of genocide-supporting charities we have revealed. They should be shut down by the Charity Commission.
Gaza, where Israel's air and artillery strikes have become a regular occurrence. In the besieged strip, sounds of bombardment are followed by screams of mothers losing their kids, as well as cries of children whose parents are killed by the regime. Tens of thousands of Palestinians, most of them women and kids, have been killed in the relentless strikes since October 7th. Humanitarian organizations report that more than 10 children on average lose one or both of their legs per day in the coastal territory. And that's just one aspect of the unending cycle of Israel's brutality against the people of Gaza. Apart from casualties, the regime's recurring attacks have caused indescribable devastation in the Palestinian territory. But when it comes to describing the true nature of the Israeli onslaught, there's no word better than genocide. There are multiple reports and countless evidence indicating that what's taking place in Gaza meets the definition of a genocidal war. Since the very beginning of the onslaught, millions of people around the world, along with a number of states, have been calling on international institutions to oblige Israel to end the genocide. South Africa is one of those states. The country, in late December, filed a lawsuit against Israel at the International Court of Justice. Now, nearly 1 month after the lawsuit was filed, the Hague-based court is set to convene on Friday to decide on South Africa's request for an interim ruling in its genocide case against Israel. The possible verdict by the ICJ would order Israel to announce a ceasefire in Gaza and allow more humanitarian aid into the Palestinian territory. In its filing, Pretoria referred to Israel's violation of the United Nations 1948 Genocide Convention. South Africa's application includes multiple offenses, from indiscriminate killing of Palestinians to the wholesale destruction of Gaza's infrastructure. Earlier in January, the Hague-based court convened two-day hearings. At the closing of the first day, the South African ambassador to the Netherlands asked the court to order Israel to immediately suspend its onslaught on the besieged strip.
One, the state of Israel shall immediately suspend its military operations in and against Gaza. Two, the state of Israel shall ensure that any military or irregular armed units which may be directed, supported, or influenced by it, as well as any organizations and persons which may be subject to its control, direction, or influence, take no steps in furtherance of the military operations referred to in point one above.
South Africa's move has been welcomed by Palestinian resistance movements. Hamas said the arguments and evidence put forth by South Africa proves Israel's crimes of genocide and ethnic cleansing in Gaza. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry also applauded the move, calling it a historic moment for humanity.
This is a historical moment for the Palestinian people and for humanity, as well as for the world order based on law.
A number of countries and international organizations have welcomed South Africa's case at the ICJ. The Organization of Islamic Countries, OIC, and the Arab League expressed their support for the case. Malaysia, Turkey, Jordan, and Iran are among the states voicing support for the motion. Israel's crimes against Palestinians in Gaza have also been referred to the International Criminal Court. Mexico and Chile have requested the ICC to probe the crimes against civilians in Gaza. Submitting lawsuits at international courts are parts of global efforts to mandate Israel to put an end to its non-stop strikes on Gaza, as their scale and nature dovetail with the widely accepted narrative that the onslaught is actually a genocidal war.
South Africa has taken the step to invoke the Genocide Convention and charge Israel in the International Court of Justice. While there are severe limitations to this process, it is undeniably momentous to see Israel brought before the highest international court to answer for its crime of genocide against the Palestinians. The relationship between South Africa and Palestine is deep and cannot be underestimated. It was forged through oppression and racial subjugation. Israel was a key player in the development and later the malignancy of apartheid rule in South Africa. South Africa's apartheid prime minister, Daniel Malan, was the first foreign prime minister to visit Tel Aviv following the Nakba. Hendrik Verwoerd, a South African apartheid architect and prime minister, even claimed in 1961 that Israel, like South Africa, is an apartheid state. That was 6 decades before Amnesty International said the same. In order to improve the image of apartheid in South Africa, Israel and the apartheid authorities established a joint secretariat for political and psychological warfare in 1975. By 1981, the apartheid army in South Africa had 200 Israeli military advisors, and hundreds of apartheid troops were also educated in Israeli military academies. Israeli military instructors provided direct guidance to the South African Reconnaissance Commando's elite unit in particular. Elbit Systems, Israel's largest arms business, played a key role in the development of South Africa's military electronics industry. South Africa's naval forces were also trained in Israel and sold radar systems by Elta, a subsidiary of the state-owned Israeli Aerospace Industries. Israel was also essential to the construction of an electric wall to police the border of apartheid South Africa, with a crew of 50 Israeli technicians stationed permanently at the wall for maintenance. The Israelis also planted radar devices and minefields along the border. Israeli intelligence agencies had a steady presence in apartheid-era South Africa. The apartheid intelligence agency BOS ran a letter bomb campaign against ANC figures like Ruth First, which employed similar methods in its Operation Wrath of God against Palestinians in Lebanon. It is thought likely that Israel provided support for this. The Israel spy agency, the ADL, also spied on many anti-apartheid activists, including Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and sold the information to BOS agents of the apartheid regime in South Africa. Israel and apartheid South Africa worked closely on nuclear research, with South African uranium proving extremely useful to Israel's covert nuclear program. Are we witnessing the revenge of history?
Islamic Revolution and Economic Progresses. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Agriculture is a key section of economy of any country, yet it was in a very poor situation before the Islamic Revolution, especially in the last decade of Pahlavi regime's unholy life. This while the Shah would mendaciously speak of great agricultural reforms in Iran. After the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, however, people and officials prioritized addressing agriculture seriously. They tried first to provide infrastructures and facilities for villages in a bid to help deprived villagers afford food security. With regards to Iran's semi-dry climate, this goal seemed very hard to materialize. Nevertheless, with sincere endeavor of villagers, an application of advanced technologies, the country managed to take agriculture to the present situation, where crops production has increased 5 times and exports have increased 10 times. Iran is currently self-sufficient in 80% of its crops. In the 5th episode of the special series on the 45th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, we are going to dwell upon progresses in agriculture and other sections. Stay tuned, please. According to the statistics of United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, the Islamic Republic of Iran ranks 1st to 10th in production of 22 crops all over the world. This is while the rainfall in Iran is one-third and the rate of water evaporation is 3 times the global average. But after the Islamic Revolution, there has been a 20% growth in production of horticultural crops. FAO report shows that Iran is the greatest producer of fruits in West Asia. Iran is the first fruit-producing country in the region, and in production of 15 horticultural crops, it stands among 10 top countries in the world. In addition, the average fruit consumption in the country is nearly 150 kilograms, which is double the global rate. The Ministry of Agriculture, Jihad, has announced that the Iranian fruits are exported to over 100 countries. Thus, in spite of the U.S. illegally imposed sanctions and harsh climatic changes, Iran's agriculture has grown dramatically after the revolution, and this has seriously maintained economic security of the nation. Besides agriculture, it should be mentioned that the Islamic Republic has gained great success in animal husbandry, fishery, and meat production. Another field in which the Islamic Republic has made great progress is the field of road construction. While before the Islamic Revolution, Iran's roads grid was too limited and restricted only to big cities, after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, big strides have been taken in construction of qualified and safe roads in cities, towns, and villages. Presently, there are 220,000 kilometers of road in Iran with a significant share of rural roads. The length of freeways has increased more than 40 times after the revolution. Surprisingly, there are more than 20,000 kilometers of highways, which is 550 times more than the pre-revolution era. Iranians own 24 million cars. This puts Iran in the 21st rank globally. As for railroad network, the Islamic Republic has enjoyed 3 times increase compared with the previous regime. In other words, the railroad length has reached 15,000 kilometers. Iran's geographical situation is in a way that it can act